set up, but I promised to offer no original thoughts. The well, thank you. I'm going to talk for a couple of minutes. It's kind of odd that Ricky asked me to speak about planning in an unplanned city, and I was the planning director for 5 years of Washington, D.C., which is probably one of the most highly planned cities. And before that, I guess I have some background of planning in Los Angeles, which may be arguably one of the most unplanned cities. So if we bring some insight into this, and I just want, you know, it's interesting. What I really want to reflect on a bit is what we're learning in the urban age as we've gone to New York, as we've gone to Shanghai, and now as we've come to London. What does this say about the state of urban planning and the relationship of urban planning and design and really broadly city building? And particularly today, really looking at the four projects over the last 2 days, the role of these mega projects in shaping the future of a city. Interestingly, in Washington, and just by way of background for a moment, because it shaped some of my comments and observations, is a city that is so highly planned from, as you saw in the mayor's press, those of you who were here in the mayor's presentations of a city planned by Lan Font, an intentional city that was very much a city by design. 100 years later, again, major intervention of the great planners of the time of Olmsted and Burnham, who laid out the mall that many people associate and see as the symbol of Washington today. And then being sort of an urban laboratory always over the years, from urban renewal, being a test case for the use of eminent domain and in urban renewal, to any number of social programs, Washington is always looked to as a bit of a laboratory. And for us, that is when I was planning director with the mayor of Washington, who is here, when we looked at the responsibility of the next, the future of Washington, and realized that we were the 100th anniversary, in fact, of the great planning of the mall and the city, which led to sort of much of the City Beautiful movement, said, what is the shape of the city to come? And we, as London has, and we took some inspiration from this, looked to our river, which had been a barrier, of the eastern part of the city, where many of the poorest neighborhoods were, and decided to define the river and a river project as a way of changing the identity of the city, but also as a means of political empowerment for a city that's been disenfranchised, as well as for creating benefits for neighborhoods that had been neglected and re-knitting the city together. So we used, in a way, how we used the scheme of a mega project to redefine the city. So bringing that perspective, just to step back for a moment, I think one of the interesting things that's happening across the board, certainly we've seen the United States and in our travels now and coming to London, is that planning and bold visions are back again. Planning in some ways seems to be emerging from the coma that it's been in and the sort of trauma that it's been in from urban renewal. When planning seemed to suffer as a result of many of the failures of urban renewal and the reaction to urban renewal, sort of a crisis of confidence, a crisis in its professionalism. Is there, in fact, do planners have something to say about the city? A crisis of government capacity and credibility and competence. Can government really plan again? Look at what it's done. It suffered from a crisis of comprehensiveness. Are you trying to do too much? You can't solve all of these problems. A crisis of participation. Did, in fact, planning involve people meaningfully and engage people? And maybe we hadn't listened enough. Maybe we need to go out and have more community participation, not just what was termed at the time maximum feasible participation, but genuine participation. And there's a sort of, it seems to me, a retreat of planning that occurred into a sort of timidity that resulted in sort of incrementalism, a sense that maybe planners aren't have as much to offer professionally, that we become more scribes of what community aspirations are than, in fact, having our own ideas about the city, and that we really, in some ways, we can't really link the physical and the social, the sort of project of the urban age. It's just too complicated, so maybe we'll look at narrower set of concerns that we can, in fact, address ourselves to. But it seems like there's been some shaking off of that, and I think one of the themes that, to me, is emerging as we've gone around is to see how cities are, again, looking at physical planning as a way of reimagining their futures and a way of mobilizing actions, and in a way, at a time when cities are often seen as being disenfranchised because of their political power within the different systems, as a way, in fact, of empowerment. And we discussed that in terms of London today and the Olympics, London in the GLA, and other examples. So what I want to talk about is that in this, in some ways, as we're entering into an age maybe of renewed confidence and exuberance about planning, what are the, and certainly I'm one who enjoys that and has been a proponent of that, what are some of the cautions and some of the lessons? And I want to draw out, I think, some of the themes from what we've heard today as we've looked at these mega projects as really hopefully a source of the conversation and reflection about what we're going about to enter at this age. Maybe it's the new urban age of planning as well. Because there is a danger, and I think Richard Sennett pointed this out very much in China, of a kind of idea virus that overcomes planners at different stages, whether it was the idea virus at the time of urban renewal, but where one model becomes so dominant that it quickly gets picked up and exported. You saw that, I mean, Richard's comments of China was a caution about are there a sort of repetition on steroids, if you will, of many of the lessons, you know, mistakes of what's happened, whether that was elevated freeways, whether it was the high-rise sprawl, whether it was neglect of the basic elements of city building and the street. We may see that, in fact, of programs that very much are viewed positively. Let's take the HOPE 6 program in the United States, a great program to rebuild the most distressed public housing and put back the fabric of the city, but quickly has gotten picked up as the one answer. And in many ways, in terms of the design, a stylistic conclusion about this is the right form of the city. We saw this in some respects of the mayors who presented at the European Mayors Forum. There was a tremendous similarity of everyone doing new urban regeneration programs, and one needs to go below the surface and ask, well, maybe the redevelopment of all of these is not the right answer. Maybe renovation in some of these is the right answer. Larry Vail raised that question. So the new urbanist, for example, a philosophy in the United States that's also here in England, which has become very, in many ways, filled a void in the debate about planning, but has quickly become, in a way, co-opted as almost a good housekeeping seal of approval for further suburbanization. So my caution is we have to be careful to go from the ideas that are shaping our cities to dogma. And that's sort of, I think, a caution in all of us as we look at these notions of how planning is reemerging in some sense to shape the city. So a few things I want to point out about the discussion we've had with that as a kind of a backdrop. One is clearly the importance of linking the larger vision for the city. I think in New York City, one of the things that we saw very clearly when was presented was we couldn't discern, and Jerry Frug pointed out, what was in fact the vision for the city. Contrast that with London, where London had the London Plan and a vision for the city, a vision for its future within projects fit. So it seems to me a fundamental that we can't just look at fragments of the city, but in fact look at what is this broader vision for the city. And we saw the difference between the two. And one could argue that since we left New York a few months ago, that the whole vision that was presented for the west side of the New York, centered on a project, which was the a stadium, was so disconnected from a vision for the city that it led ultimately to its failure because they couldn't make the connection, contrasted with London. That the Olympics was very much a part of the notion of London's image, identity, and future. So we can begin to learn something, I think, about the importance of the overall framework of vision for the city and its connection to these projects. A second issue, I think, is one of boundaries. I think we saw clearly today this tension about boundaries. How do we define these projects, these parts of the city? Do we look at them from the project out or from the neighborhood in? The zone of influence that was pointed out in the plan, I thought it was a very good presentation on the Olympics plan, but talked about the zone of influence. Maybe, in fact, it's the project that's the zone of influence, and it is the neighborhood around it that, in fact, the plan is about, if we're serious about how to connect project to the existing fabric of the city. So this question of how we define boundaries and how we draw them is not just how do we extend the grid from our project to the neighborhood and where a street goes through, but in fact how we define the whole project itself as a rebuilding project. Second, related to that are not just geographic boundaries, but disciplinary boundaries. I think, you know, the presentation on the white city was sort of as if parallel universes between the designer of the project and the economist of the project. I didn't understand where they were connecting. In fact, the economist didn't really connect into what that project was about. And so many times these disciplinary boundaries, and Dieter pointed this out, prevent us from having this better integration of planning that is not just the form, but in fact the substance, which leads to a point about how to look at these plans, which is I think we get very enamored as planners and designers of large targets. This plan is going to produce 12 million square feet of development, 20,000 housing units, 3 million square feet, etc. And we say, this is wonderful, this sounds great, it's big, it's bold, it's transforming. What does that mean? And I think we have to start asking ourselves these questions and go to a finer grain level of analysis. Who are we planning for? What do these targets mean? Now, obviously, you can't predict all of these. These are 20-year plans. But you have to at least start from the basis, not from the end state back, but forward thinking about the grain of the city. So Dieter raised the question, what is the economy of the city, of the white city? What is the real base that you're trying to attract here? What does the form of that look like? Who are the people in the communities around that you're going to start to integrate into this? So that these aren't just abstractions, and we don't become enamored with numbers, or frankly enamored with models and beautiful models, because those are all going to be thrown out over the next year, or as soon as the competition is won, or as the market changes. So we have to really understand what is the foundation of these visions and not become too enamored. Which comes to, I think, a tension that we have that's been identified by Ann Power, which is the tension between the new city and the existing city. And given that we constantly are, no matter how wealthy a city may become, in an age of scarcity, there's always scarcity. There is always a question of a limited amount of resources. And that we not become so enamored of the investments in all the large projects that we forget the important infill work that needs to be done. The sense that how many units could one have, I think Ann pointed out how many units one could have if you were to just do a series of infill projects. Less glamorous, less sexy, less identifiable, but nonetheless important in terms of building the fabric of the city, and then not lose this sense, as in many ways urban renewal lost a sense of the investment in the fabric of the existing city, because all of our attention turned to the mega project of the city. Now, it's not to say one should do one, and it's not an either-or proposition. I would never suggest that. It's just a question of how we always in mind have the balance of that investment and a balance of our attention. My next point, how much time? You have to give me a warning. So, okay, great. My next 35 points are as follows. Which is this sense of, and this was raised yesterday by Fred, what do we mean by comprehensiveness? I think we saw in all the presentations, and I'm sure there's more to it than just was presented, but the physical was, again, leading. And I think all of us are very drawn to that, the physical image of the city, the physical form of the city. What was the sort of social infrastructure and social program? The Olympics started to lay out what they believed a social program was going to be for East London. But I think you didn't see, and we have to make sure that in our planning, that it is not the afterthought. That in fact the social parts of these plans are very much integrated in how we're presenting what that future for the city is, and that it is not simply a matter of what I would say is the sort of discussion that we had about the trickle-down effect of plans versus the direct effect of plans. That many times when we look at these, we say, here are the outcomes, here are the outputs, and it will have this benefit, a hoped-for benefit, that will occur sometime in the future that will be good for the city. The question is, how do we create direct benefits? And maybe one way to look at this, just as an example, and this is all these examples are flawed, but is we also have to think about not just the physical and the economic, but the financial structure of plans to achieve benefits. Battery Park City is a mega project 30 years ago in New York, which was a landfill site, desolate, you know, had a very simple idea, which was that one day this was going to be extremely profitable. And they decided that a percent of all of the revenue that flowed from Battery Park City should be used for affordable housing. Now, they didn't use it for affordable housing, that's a different question, but the aspiration was that it would, and today is about $60 to $70 million that could be used for affordable housing. So there are ways that these benefits aren't elusive in the future, but in fact are built into the very fabric of these plans and are not disconnected, which leads to a question and I think an observation about the actual physical form of these plans and what we're starting to see come forward, which is given what was pointed out yesterday, the sort of indeterminacy, and that we can't predict what ultimately the architecture is going to be or how the city's going to evolve. We have to go, and I want to pick up on Richard's point, from in a sense the bird's eye view to maybe the human eye view of the city, which is how do we start to, in the presentation and in the formulation of plans, begin to build up from what we think some of the basics of the building of a city are, the places. I think Richard pointed out very well, what is this place? How do we define these, not just as forms, as geometry, and but actually as, you know, what kind of places will be created? What will be the public realm? What would be left as the physical framework of this plan, should it change 100 and 200 times over? That those elements, that sense of the mixture that Klaus spoke of, the sense of allowing for the evolution of this, but at the end of the day, for example, you know, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania today, who knew that the four squares that defined that city when they did them were, there was no economic analysis that would ever say that made sense, but they knew that that was going to be a structure for that city that persisted. In the same way, so we translate these into the kind of places and not become overly obsessed, as I think is happening in the United States, with style. Whether that is a new urbanist style or whether a modernist style, that's going to change 100 times over, but that the basics of the physical building block should be in place. Which leads to my final point. My final point is, what about delivery? I would say that, you know, all these great, that the fact that we have returned to bold visions for the city, I think is very powerful. But those bold visions only happen if there's actually delivery mechanisms that can execute those visions. Gerald Frug pointed out this tension we have between, is big city building possible, or do you have, without suspending democracy, which was a point raised earlier, can you have your cake and eat it too? Can you have big vision and democracy, or are those two fundamentally in conflict? And I would say that one place we should look, and obviously I'm biased, bringing bias to this, but I think the merging of these two conferences pointed this out, was to the fact that we had 10, 12 mayors here? 12 mayors here. Who are the designers in many ways? Who can make these decisions, or at least shape some of the decisions in the city, are these the mayors? And how do the mayors, how do we as a profession, how do those of us concerned about cities begin to do what this conference started to do, which is to educate mayors, empowering mayors, both with the knowledge and the courage and the mechanisms to be able to really influence urban form. Each one of these projects we saw today, and the four here, and then in New York, involved incredibly complex systems of the relationship of the state to the city to the community, the city to the federal government, and you always get the sense of who's actually in charge. The London experience of moving to more and more empowerment of a mayor seems to me a place that we need, on the one hand, to look to, but on the other hand, obviously, we can't have purely top-down, we can't have purely bottom-up, or these large visions will never be executed if left to parochialism. We have to find a balancing between empowering and emboldening mayors to represent a city, and at the same time having not just participation, but actually a dialogue and a true representation of neighborhoods in that process. But that only occurs, it seems to me, if it's balanced against what the vision for the city is, what the aspirations for a neighborhood are, and what a larger sense of constituency, as Frank pointed out, can become, or else will be lost somewhere in this continuum of planning between what the big vision was and what the small vision was. We have to come to a new medium, a new way of operating, so these bold visions can both be executed and have the ownership of those places and communities that we intend, or at least state that we're hoping to serve, and we need to do that directly rather than indirectly. So those are some of my observations to get this going.